welcome Michael to give presentations that I'm going to be asking him to do.
The last one. That looks familiar. Thanks. Morning, everybody. It's a pleasure to be invited back to this conference to talk about the weird and wonderful internet. I'm not going to be talking about library-specific stuff. I'm going to be talking about us as a species. But I do hope that whatever I have to say in the next half hour or so does contribute to librarian goodness. What a lovely phrase. We've had love this morning, and we've had librarian goodness. I'm going to try and talk about this and fit it within the conference themes of adapt and change and evolve. I did actually think about looking at the definitions of those words, but they're too close, and I thought I'd actually try this angle. So I'm going to put this slant on those three words as I go through the various examples of things I want to show you. Adapt is something that you can do. This is the proactive stance, and we've seen some examples of that this morning, particularly the people from South Bank Institute and what they're doing with their own library to kind of push it out to people. So you can be proactive, and be an active agent in the adaptation process. I've chosen to think of change as that thing that happens to you. You know, it's all too much. You just sit back and it just washes over you and you all feel a bit helpless. And evolve is what's going to happen whatever we do. However we feel, that's just going to happen. Did anyone show this yesterday? No? I don't know whether you've seen it before. I just had to go looking for it because it's at least 10 years old. It may be more. So very early on in the days of the internet, this graphic started floating around, and you'll notice there's no attribution. There is reference to where I found it, but if you search for this image on the internet, it's on hundreds of sites, and there's nary a reference to who created it or anything. So it's just one of those things that came onto the internet, probably in days when people weren't particularly fussed about attributing works, and there it is. So it's an interesting take on how we were changing as a species 10 years plus back. I want to look at these three theories of technology to help us frame the discussion in the next 30 minutes or so. So we've got three theories there. The first one is technological determinism, which basically is a bit like the change happens to us. Technology's in control, there's nothing we can do, and it just acts upon us and it changes us. The social construction of technology model is an interesting one. It's almost as if, you know, we as a species have this collective subconscious that operates and decides this is the time we need the internet. This is the time we need technology X. And the prevailing ethics and values of the time dictate what we do with that technology. So it's acknowledging, more than technological determinism, the fact that we are an active player in the kinds of technology that we create and how we use it. A middle ground between these two theories is that of social shaping. It's been written about by people like Nancy Baim, who calls technologies, or she refers to have technologies have ethics. Nicholas Carr, a more recent writer, talks about them having ethics, and these are the messages that a tool or medium transmits into the minds and cultures of its users. And we'll come back to that idea in a while. A quick recap on where we've been. Internet originally was not called the Internet version 1, but it was pretty much a book. We went there to get stuff. It was a passive experience. Few of us contributed to it. Unless you had the skills in writing HTML, designing web pages, well, the internet was a place that you just went and got things. It lasted, 5 to 8 years, and then we did have a new version of the internet, and it was called version 2. In fact, it was called Web 2.0, and it's still referred to as that. Tim Berners-Lee, the guy who's accredited as being the inventor of the internet, refers to it as the read-write web and says it was always the internet that he imagined would come. The internet where you and me contribute to it, whether it's Facebook, blogs, taking photographs, putting stuff on YouTube, every one of us is an equal partner in creating this astounding resource. So, is Stephen Downes probably the foremost commentator on internet and education in the world, referred to a companion notion of e-learning 2.0 or 2.0. There's the contrast between the two. E-learning 2.0 was more student-centered. It involves students generating and sharing content, much the same way as they do, for example, on Facebook and YouTube. And students had come into a world where they were not just interacting with their teachers and their people in their classroom, but could, in theory, get information from anybody in the world that, chose to. Now, this is an evolution of a kind of learning from one to another. I'd like to say there was a lot more evidence of e-learning 2.0 around, but my quick scan of the state of not only TAFE in Australia, but all school sectors, maybe with the possible exception of primary schools, is that they're still bogged down in e-learning 1.0. That's my opinion. So Web 2 is dominated by social media. We are all well familiar with that now. There are the big names. It's Facebook, it's YouTube, it's Twitter, and a whole host of others, and there are hundreds of them. Much to my chagrin, I don't know how you feel about it, but Facebook almost became the internet. And I think for some people, it is. I don't think they do much else. It's estimated that 80% of all internet traffic is Facebook. You only need to look onto the screens of people probably here on this campus, internet cafes anywhere in the world, check what they're looking at. They're looking at Facebook. On the bus yesterday from the airport in Melbourne, the woman next to me, she was on Facebook. Most of the time, when you look at screens that people are using on their whatever device, it's Facebook. The good news is, Facebook finally plateaued last year at about 800 million users. So maybe its influence will not increase any further, but I wish I could say that confidently. I don't know why. I think it's difficult for people like me, and there might be people here in the room the same, that you were a well-experienced internet user before Facebook came along, and then it hijacked all these things that you could already do. We didn't need Facebook to do all these things, but of course people have come online after 2005. They saw Facebook first, and Facebook gave them all these amazing affordances, and so they've fallen in love with it. And good on Facebook. We'll return to Facebook in a minute. So we live in a world now where there's a network, and these little dots here represent us. Every one of these dots is a person. The lines on this graphic are the lines between people to represent the kinds of communications or links that we have between each other. And in the globally connected world, we've become familiar with this phrase, the knowledge is in the network. And this is interesting from a librarian's point of view, because once upon a time you had to remember stuff. People were tested on it. That's what school was based on. And there's still lots of testing in TAFE is based on the fact that you remember stuff. And there's a school of thought that says you don't need to remember things anymore, because it's out there on the internet, or it's in your network. Within 5, 10 minutes, maybe an hour, you ask any question you like. If your knowledge, if your network is correct, or if it's accurate, if it's well chosen, you'll get the information you need. So you don't need to remember things, because you just grab it just in time, as the previous speaker just said. This is evolution. This is people changing to a different way of learning, where they're no longer bothering to remember anything. The important thing is more, how do you get it and where do you get it from when you need it? There's an interesting kind of subplot to this where people are saying, well, it's getting mentally lazy. If we don't have to remember anything and the skill is becoming to know how to use your network, I mean, isn't that what kind of... There's a whole lot of brain capacity not being used. And again, I'll return to that theme later about what we humans might do in the new paradigm of the new internet, because we're not going to be doing the same things. I think that's pretty clear. There are a lot of things that we used to spend our time doing that we will not be doing and maybe are not already doing in the new regime. So the horizon, and I use the word horizon here to flag the Horizon Report, and some of you will be familiar with this. It comes out once a year, and it tries to make best guesses about what technologies are going to be mainstream in education within given timeframes. Within 1 year, 2 to 3 years, and 4 to 5 years. This is the report from Australia this year, and there are some things there you might be familiar with. I'm going to focus first of all on the two down on the distant horizon. The so-called Internet of Things and wearable technology. We'll also refer to some of these others, but I'm going to start with the Internet of Things and wearable technologies. But before, you don't hear the phrase Internet. Well, you do occasionally hear, you know, what's Internet 3.0 look like? A couple of years ago, you'd hear this fairly regularly, but you don't hear it very much. You used to hear this phrase a lot. Oh, we're moving towards the semantic web. And I must confess, I've always had trouble understanding what's actually meant by the semantic web. I know what semantic means. I mean, it's about making meaning. But how does the web make meaning? Well, there is a goal out there, and people are working on scripts and code to turn the internet into something where computers can actually read the data, determine what it means, and do intelligent things with the resulting information. So not just feed it back to us, but actually draw conclusions in the same way that we might. So in that example there, and I tried this on Google the other night, if you put, I'm looking for somewhere to go on holiday that's hot, good food, within 2 hours flying time, $300 a week, and I'm vegetarian, Google just gives you a list of travel sites. There might come a time where you'd put that into Google or whatever search engine, and it will actually tell you the destination you should go, because it's gone to all the different places. It's now the semantic web. It can interpret data in a way that it can't now and actually make these decisions for you. Again, what are we going to do with our time? What are we going to do with our brain if we have a web that can make decisions like this for us? The Internet of Things, or written, you'll see that abbreviation, maybe you already have, IoT, if you see that, they're talking about the Internet of Things. And the Internet is being released from screens. In the graphic there, which is probably a bit small for you to see clearly, you can see there are people there on the left of the graphic, or there are locations where stuff has been tracked, where sensors are picking up data, sending it to a server, which is going to the Internet, and it's been on... So I'm forwarded on to the people who are actually analysing the data. So the users, us, the people, are still living and looking at screens. But there's a whole realm of activity that's happening on the internet before it reaches us. And some examples of these things are one I heard the other day that people back home are looking at monitoring fish tank temperatures and the quality of the water and the amount of food that fish are eating, because they don't... And this is all kind of in real time, is sent to the internet. And so someone who's monitoring this data at the other end can see, there's something wrong with the water, we need to act. But they don't need to be in the room. They could be in Timbuktu. It doesn't matter where they are. They check this on the internet, probably on this, every couple of hours, just to make sure the fish back home in TAFE, South Australia, are okay. I was at a presentation recently where a guy was wearing just a wristband. It was taking his pulse, his blood pressure, his temperature, in real time, sending that data back to his doctor in the United States, who similarly could either, you know, every half hour check this, or maybe he gets a beep, 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 and says, you know, David, his patient in Australia at the moment, has all of a sudden a rise in blood pressure. He can contact David, so we need to see you, something's going on. And countless examples of where the internet is now tracking data, and it's been stored and interpreted by people, but the internet is gathering in information from a million different sources. A couple more. The bottom left there, saving energy using the Internet of Things. These are a group of people working in Sweden, and they're working on a project, and it's a matchbox, apparently. The device they've decided... created, a bit bigger than this, about the size of a matchbox, just sits in your apartment. It monitors lighting, wind, breeze, humidity, temperature, and anything else that affects heat and comfort levels, and it controls your air conditioning. You never touch it. It makes all the decisions for you. That data is streaming to the internet. So imagine thousands of homes, millions of homes across the world using this gadget, and all that data is going to the internet. The example on the right, this thing called the Ubi, it's about the size, about so big. It sits on the wall, and it's been designed specifically for people who have disabilities. So they're either immobile, or it works so that I just talk to it. So I'm sitting in my chair, it's on the wall. Ubi, please bring up my Facebook page, please. Ubi, what's the cricket score? Ubi, what's... take me to Google News or something, whatever, and it talks back the information to you. So you don't need the screen. You don't need to see anything. So Ubi is a screen reader, in effect, or it goes off somewhere, gathers the data that it receives via audio and sends it back via audio. It's available on the web now, $279. Could have been pounds, but they're available. This is the one that's really going to put the cat among the pigeons. Wearable computing. And the internet is just a fantastic example so often of... I saw a phrase the other day which I hadn't heard before, and I think it's a really good one, creative destruction. It creates so many wonderful things, and on the other hand, it destroys so much. We've seen bookshops go, we've seen record stores go, newspapers go, and a whole list of things that have disappeared because of the internet. And one of the things that is about to disappear is privacy. Because this thing here on the left, Google Glass, is a 24-hour camera recording device. Some of you may be familiar with point-of-view technology, which has been used in TAFEs around the country, where you put these glasses on, it records everything it sees and everything it hears. And it's really good for people demonstrating the practical skill, because they've got a full video of the fact that it was them doing it. But we're moving now to the place where people are wearing these things 24/7. You'll see them wandering around life. They'll be on campus, in the shopping centre, on the bus, walking down the street. And if they walk past you, you're on their film. If you say something, what you say is on their film. They have been released in the United States to limited users. The rumour is they'll be released in Australia in March for about $1,500. The little gadget on the right is the photo equivalent, the still image equivalent. It used to be called Momoto. If you check these things, Momoto had to change the name to this narrative. It's a little camera. It's about so big. It sits there. Or you could put it here. It doesn't really matter where. You could put it on your hat. It takes a photograph every 30 seconds, all day long, all week long. And at any given point, you go and you see what it's done, and you take the photos that you think might be useful and trash the rest. I've worn this for a day. Fascinating. Fascinating to know how it affects what you do. Fascinating how it affects other people. This is a really good example of, you wear a technology like that and we change. It will change the way we behave. Why would you do all this? Well, there's the question. But it's going to happen. Google Glass also has the ability to do augmented reality. So if you were walking past the Brisbane City Hall, for example, you could actually, now I don't know whether you touch something here or whether you talk to it, but it would bring up an overlay of data about Brisbane City Hall or whatever. So this is the future. This is the great side of this wearable computing. I just want to go back actually and mention ubervalence is the word that's been coined to describe this. We know what surveillance is, ubervalence. Uber comes from the German everywhere, and it's because we'll be living in a world where it will be everywhere. These people here, I think they're in Melbourne. They put electrodes half a millimetre thick into your brain, and it's designed to detect abnormal activity and deliver instant treatment. Good for treating seizures, pain, psychiatric conditions, and Parkinson's disease. Now, this is like the guy wearing the wristband. This is a step towards living for 100 years, living for 120 years. We're going to be living in a society where it's going to be harder to get sick, because they'll know in advance that something's changing in your body, which is an indicator that you're going to get Parkinson's, so they'll stop it before it happens. This is amazing stuff. This is nothing but positive. And we're just on the brink of this aspect of wearable computing clearly being an advantage for everybody. But Google Glass, apologise for some of the information on the graphic on the left, a bit hard to read, but the top left there, 65% in this study in the United States says it will revolutionise the way we behave. Well, I think that's probably right. 70% across all ages would buy it. So who here would buy Google Glass? It came on sale in March for $1,500. We've got one, two, three, we've got half a dozen or so. See, it's going to happen. So this time next year, you'll be walking around the streets of your town, and you'll quite frequently spot people with Google Glass. The work on the right there, or the information on the right, was a study of people in Britain, 4,000 people, and about 20% of them were very suspicious of Google and the whole idea of being able to have 24/7 surveillance of everywhere these people go, and believed it should be banned outright. Of course, I mean, it's a very large threat to the way that we have been living. So privacy, is it a constitutional or human right? I had my mind, if not changed, influenced significantly by this book. A guy called Jeff Jarvis, he's an American academic, wrote this book called Public Parts. And I guess he has two principal messages. Turns out, like a lot of things that we hold dear and that we cherish in the Western world, privacy hasn't been around that long. It's the province of we privileged living in a developed world with a very high standard of living. Most of the world, they don't have privacy ever. They're never on their own, ever. I mean, to put it bluntly, to have intercourse at night, you're doing it in the same room as four or five children, or in a paper-thin wall with the next couple. You just don't have privacy. And I remember being in Sri Lanka, where I stayed for some time, and I'd have crowds of people watching me as I wrote in my diary, or I'd be reading, and I'd have four or five people sitting around watching me. And I asked my friend, who was my host, and said, why? And he said, well, they don't want you to be alone. You wouldn't want to be alone. They kind of found it curious anyway, but the main thing was they were just making sure I wasn't alone, that I didn't have privacy, because it's a Western notion of a developed world. So Jeff Jarvis is saying, we're just going back to what was. It's been a fairly recent thing, and we lived most of our evolution, most of humanity's history has been basically in the public eye, and we're just going back to it, and we're going to find it really hard to let go of what we've learned to be privacy. But I'm being a little bit provocative here, but I think there's a case to be made for it's not that big a deal. Are we going to adapt, resist? Are we going to just change? Are we going to accept? But it's going to, if you can use evolve as an active verb, it's going to evolve us. We will change. And the other thing about privacy that he makes is the one where, and this is particularly relevant in organisations, that privacy allows things to be that aren't particularly good or ethical or wise to be hidden. Basically, that's one of privacy's roles in organisations and within relationships, is to make sure the bad stuff is hidden. In a world where privacy is kind of jettisoned as something useful, everything's open, problems are fixed, because you can't get away with bad stuff, you know, under the carpet or behind the doors, because there are no closed doors. So, repeating the mind, or the message from earlier, that these tools will transmit messages into us, their users. Marshall McLuhan put it this way. So, pre-internet, talking about other technologies, we shape our tools, and thereafter the tools shape us. About a year ago, a friend of mine who works in this area of ubervalence, he's actually doing a PhD, rang me up quite late one night and said, Michael, are you awake? Do you mind if we talk? I said, yeah, okay, what's up? He had been to a conference where most of the people present were military, police, and security. And he was basically freaked out because he had spent 2 days with these people who had the attitude, it was not if, to this question, will we be microchipped? It's when. And they can't bring it on fast enough. Because imagine the job of a policeman or army or security. You know, they scan you, there's your age, there's your picture, there's your profile, great, on you go. Makes their life really, really easy. There are already some nightclubs in the world. I think there's two in Berlin, two in New York, where you don't get in unless you've got a chip and they scan you in. It's not if, it's when. And there are significant portions of this society that we live in right now, as I say, who cannot wait. Big data was mentioned this morning by Sue, I think. And this is really interesting. And you may have heard the phrase that data is the new oil. So oil was what made countries rich in the 1980s, 90s, maybe even into the noughties. But now it's going to be data. And it probably won't be countries that will become rich, but it will be organisations. We've already seen it with Facebook and Google. What has made Facebook and Google absolutely wealthy beyond our imaginations is their ownership of data and the ability to on-sell it to interested parties, principally advertisers. So every time you click something in Facebook, every time you do a search on Google, that data is stored and it is aggregated and it is sold on to third parties at an enormous price. So that's one aspect of big data. The other aspect of big data is with the Internet of Things and the examples that I mentioned, but all that data has been fed into the Internet. I mean, it's already a huge place with millions and, you know, of gigabytes, terabytes, and there's another one beyond terabytes, which I forget. It's going to be an exponential increase in the amount of information going into the Internet, so we've got massive amounts of data. Who owns it? Who controls it? Who can sell it? Who can get access to it? This will be the currency of the next generation of the Internet. In the education space, we're seeing it in a much lower scale, if you like, with learning analytics. You may be familiar with learning analytics. It's that process where you track a student's behaviour in an e-space and make predictions about what kind of help they need. So the good side of learning analytics is that it can flag the fact that after week four, this student needs help. And the lecturer gets a message and the student gets a message, you're in dire straits, you're going to fail, see your lecturer now or do these resources. So it's not just left to the lecturer to make the decision or the student to make the decision. The software now tells, you know, rings, da, ba, bup, you're in trouble. So our existing learning management systems like Moodle and Blackboard already do this to some extent because they have reports in them that you as a teacher can go in and look at and get the information this way. But there are already lots of organisations in the world who are employing another overlay of other software which is tracking that data and producing these kind of reports in the field of learning analytics. So this is data being used, machines, software making decisions based on that data and telling you, rather than you having to find out that student's in trouble, it tells you, act now, student needs help. This is kind of me dreaming, but I also think there's interesting stuff going on in this respect because at the moment the world consists of thousands of databases of information, silos of information all over the world. And at the moment, it's a researcher's job or a librarian's job to go to each of those places to answer any of the kinds of questions up there on the screen. Now, they're fairly insignificant, trite little questions, but you know, they would amuse me if I could actually go to Google. So how many people came to arrive in Adelaide by plane on June the 23rd, 2004? Google can't tell me that now, but it will, because there is a really interesting move going on in the big data space, and some of it's government-led, but they want to break down the silos, and they want all of that stuff to be open so that they can interrogate, the word is, so that machines can interrogate all those databases and make decisions based on the information it finds. If I had to find this out now, I mean, if I... that question there, I'd need to go to the arrivals at Adelaide Airport. I'd probably have to check Qantas, Virgin and any other airline that came into Adelaide. I'd need to check the immigration. I'd have to go to three or four places to get all the information to get the answer to this question. Imagine a world where that information's available because all those databases are talking to each other. So this is adaptation. This is us changing the way we use existing information. The LA Police Department footnote there, this is amazing, and I just find this is amazing. There's a lot of data about who commits crimes in LA, and they've been collecting it, and I honestly don't remember whether it's 30 years or 50 years, but for decades they've got data on who commits crimes, where they commit them, what kinds of crimes, and what time of day. So guess what they're doing? They're making predictions about where crime may happen in LA on a Wednesday afternoon in summer and putting patrols in the neighbourhood, and it's kind of working. They're increasing the amount, catching people in the act or even preventing crimes before they're happening. So they're using information, the patterns of the past, to predict the patterns of this week and next week. And that's fantastic. Going to be much harder to commit a crime. unless you do something that no one's ever done. You may be familiar with this, the AusGold initiative, and again, it's coming from the federal government, and this is one of the areas that they're pushing to have these silos of information broken down so they can all interrogate each other in the government space, because it creates better policy. Like the LA Police Department, they can actually look at the data and make more informed decisions about what's likely to be in a particular suburb or a particular area of concern and have policy that better matches the facts. This is not specifically internet related, but I just think we need to talk about it because we are on the verge of, I think this is another revolution on its own, 3D printing. This object here is just a screw or that goes around a cable or a wire. It's made of plastic or something similar to that, and it's been 3D printed. They have 3D printed ears. They are 3D printing food. You can 3D print a table. In fact, there isn't much that you can't 3D print. So how this is going to work, and it's fascinating that this is happening at the time in the Western world when the manufacturing industries are collapsing, that we could all take over the same tasks at home. Now, the example that's often mentioned is on a remote control unit at home, there's the back panel. They often fall off. They often get lost. If you've got a 3D printer at home, you just print one off, make a new one. You don't go out and buy one. You just print it off yourself. Now, there'll be a cost for that. So what you're going to have is a new industry where you go to, it'll be the internet, and say, oh, this is what I need, and they'll send you back the template or the drawing that your computer needs to print it out, and that'll be the cost. And I read something the other day, you'll have a pair of shoes that no one in the world has got, only you've got them, because it's absolutely customised to you. You've paid for the design, they create it, they send it back to you, you hit print to your machine, which you've got in your own office, in the kitchen, prints out your shoes. We're going to be all making our own stuff in little cottage industries. Within 5 years from now, a good 3D printer is $1,500. Within 5 years, it's going to be well under $1,000, and they'll be in every home. I'll skip badges. I want to talk about this because this was science fiction for me, and it happened a few months ago in Canberra. These guys had been working in augmented reality, so that's the same thing that where Google Glass could actually tell you, and if you can do this now, you've got an AR, augmented app on your phone, you can walk around Brisbane and go hold it up for the Brisbane City Hall and it will give you information about Brisbane City Hall. These guys are holding up, he's got an iPad and he's got a chart, and on that chart is a code. And the iPad is connected to a screen which is beaming the image onto the floor. So what appeared in the front of the room was a full-scale, effectively a hologram of the Mars rover, right there in front of us, with every detail, exact scale replica. And it was science fiction, and it was absolute magic. And I just thought, we do live in wonderful times. It's a bit clunky so far, because it's got to do this, but we'll get better at that. But we now have the technology to produce an image, a 3D image, right there in front of the class, so let's look at it. You don't have to spend too much time thinking about technology and people before you eventually start to think of robots. And just coincidentally, I don't know whether you saw it, somewhere in Australia at the moment, there was a report a couple of days ago that they're trialling the use of robot baby seals with people who have dementia. Now, this is not internet in particular, but it's certainly technology. And it's making people with dementia feel calmer, happier, like they've got company. It settles them. They've tried the same with cats and dogs. Didn't work so well, because they have preconceptions of what a cat and a dog should be like. And of course, robot cats and dogs, well, of course, so far, robot cats and dogs aren't good enough. They don't have any preconception of what a baby seal might be like, so they're really happy with their baby seals as someone that keeps them company. Sherry Turkle has written a lot about this. It's a very big book, but it's a fascinating read, and she basically documents every trial and experiment that's ever happened with humans and robots over the last 30 years. And she has data and lots of research to back this up. Over the last 30 years, we have become increasingly more open about the idea of having a robot as friend or carer. 30 years ago, don't be stupid. Totally rejected the idea. Now, old people, sick people, people who live alone, people who have dementia, quite happy with the idea of having a robot as a friend or carer. We've changed. We've changed. We have evolved. This was also just a couple of days ago, and I don't know whether I agree with this, but I want to ask you. People, it says, often approach computers and tablets with a state of mind less conducive to learning than the one they bring to paper. So when you're about to read on a device, your phone, your iPad, your e-reader, Kindle, whatever, how do you feel? And do you feel any different when you contemplate reading a book? Does it matter? Is it better or worse? But I just posed the question. Does that feel different to that? And does it matter? This guy has written a wonderful book about how we should all behave on the internet. Generation X, Y, boomers, everybody. Because he, I think, has released the book that it's like the handbook to the sensible use of the internet. And basically, it's just going back to be mindful, have a purpose. Whenever you're on the internet, have a goal, achieve it. When you've achieved it, get off. And he's coined this word, infotension. So it's not a new thing, but it's a great book, and it's helped me realize I waste a lot of time on the net, that I need to be more efficient and be more structured in the way I use it. So I just throw out, I just think it's the classic. It's the book that, this is like the social construction of technology. This book had to be written by someone. So we kind of unearthed Howard Rheingold, and he wrote the book that needed to be written for everybody. This is really important, this stuff. I mean, everything's important, so it's all a matter of, you know, what you think is important, but the book here called The Filter Bubble, some of you may have come across it, written by Eli Pariser about 3 years ago. He just had a sneaking suspicion that something wasn't quite right when he was doing searches on Google. So one day he asked a group of friends, I think 6 to 10 people, he sent them a search query and said, look, could you all do this now? So he had them doing it at the same time. Take a screenshot of what Google delivers and send it back to me. And do you know what he found? They were all different. Every single one of them was different. Google sends you a search list based on your history, based on your interest, based on your connections, based on everything it knows about you. Google is turning you into the person it thinks you want to be. Now, this is dangerous. It's done under the guise of customization, personalization. Isn't that fantastic? You get the stuff you need without having to worry about all that other stuff that you don't really want to know. But what this does, of course, is close your world down into a particular worldview where you're no longer even hearing about the other world. And Facebook's doing the same. Facebook decides who it's going to produce in your feed. You've got 200 friends, you get the feed from 30 of them because Facebook's made the decision. These are the actual people you're interested in. Don't worry about them. LinkedIn is doing the same. When you get these, oh, Joe has endorsed you for your school, the next Y and Z. No, he didn't, because I've asked Joe and he didn't. LinkedIn made it up. They are bots crawling over these sites, turning us into the people they think we want to be. We've got to be aware of it, and I don't know what we do about it, but we've got to know about it. The Future of the Internet was a book written by Jonathan Citrain. The reference there in and how to stop it is about the fact that there are periodic discussions about that governments and even companies will say, we have to stop this. We can't allow this to be the internet. We have to control it. We have to censor it. Zittrain says that we have the internet we have because it's an open and transparent philosophy and architecture, and I think he actually created this word too. It's generative. Now, if you think of everything that runs on the internet, everything from movies to voice tools to Flash to crazy graphics to everything. It doesn't matter what you throw at the internet, it plays it. And it does that because it was deliberately designed by Tim Berners-Lee and company to do that way back, that it will play anything. As long as we have an internet with that kind of architecture, then it's going to lead to endless innovation. Close it down, lock it up, then all that innovation will go, and so will a lot of the bad stuff. So we're forever in this rocking on a hard place with the internet. Creative destruction. It creates, it destroys. And where do we stand? I've changed my mind on a lot of things. I used to think things like microchipping were just science fiction. It wouldn't happen in my lifetime. I didn't think that we would clone a sheep in my lifetime. The stem cell research is something, another example of stuff that my dentist actually said to me the other day as he's doing some work on my teeth. He says, in 5 years' time, we won't need to do this. I'll just put a little stem cell in that'll grow your tooth back. I thought that humanity was the kind of species that when these sorts of things came up, you know, if we're going to, we've got the technology to clone a sheep, we'd talk about it first, about whether or not it was a good idea, and we'd decide whether or not we'd do it. No. We'd do it. Then we talk about it. That's what I've decided we are. So microchipping, we won't talk about it. We'll do it. Then we'll have the conversation. Google Glass, we didn't talk about it. We made it. So if we can do it, we will. Now, I want to flip the question that I asked at the beginning, which was the title of this presentation, where is the internet taking us? I want to ask, where are we taking the internet? Because I think we're at a particularly very curious, maybe potentially powerful, I might be naive and romantic, but we know what's going on. We are globally connected. We know what's happening here in Sydney and Africa and everywhere. We can actually track the patterns. We can track the changes in behavior. We can track things like Google and Facebook, which are doing it, and we can have the conversation. When the printing press came on board 400 or 500 years back, the people who were living at that time had no idea how the world was going to change as a result of that technology. And it's very interesting looking back and reading what people said. And some insert internet for printing, and you basically had the same conversations 500 years ago. But they didn't know what was happening. We do. So we, as a species, don't have to sit back and let it happen to us. We can actually adapt, be proactive, and say, we don't want this, we want this. So, I mean, that's a pretty crazy idea, but can we control our evolution? I'm just going to leave you with that. Thanks.